And so a lot of the checks and balances that we think are so crucial when the state wields coercive and even fatal violence are absent in a lot of these extra-legal, non-state, and prison-based situations. So certain elements of the market emerge, but the politics and the governance doesn't necessarily emerge alongside that or at the same speed.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is David Scarbeck, Professor of Political Economy and Director of the Center for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at Brown University. David's award-winning book, The Social Order of the Underworld, How Prison Gangs Govern the American Penal System, challenges the view that inmates create prison gangs to promote racism and violence. On the contrary, David argues that gangs form to create order and protection within prisons. His book explores prison governance and economics, and in many ways also asks us to look closely at the hierarchy and functioning of the world outside of prison. David, welcome to the show.
Great. Happy to be with you.
You know, I think economics is unlike most other fields. We start off with simplifications, toy models, and conventional wisdom. And instead of sharpening our understanding and updating these concepts as we go deeper, a lot of the time those initial simplifications stick even among the educated public and the government, whether it's the origins of money, the actual role of barter trade, the formation of nations. These questions often get given a treatment that doesn't reflect the nuance or history, perhaps because it's difficult to remove ourselves from the subject matter. We are fish in the ocean trying to study water. However, prisons are an interesting area where economic and political theories can be tested and observed from the outside. Prisons are mostly self-contained. They exist within a system of official rules, but are also governed by rules emerging from within. Prisons have connections to the outside, but there is value, incentives, and motivated participants literally locked within these systems. I want to start off with understanding what motivated you to write about prison economics and governance, please.
I mean, there's a personal and professional connection. Growing up in the Bay Area in California, I was very much aware of mass incarceration, some of the political effects, some of the social effects. I knew a number of people who had been incarcerated for, you know, short times and longer times. And when one particular individual was released after about 10 years, you know, he became a good friend and we chatted often about it. And so I was always curious about how those experiences had unfolded for him and how they had impacted him in ways that, you know, might not be easily written down or quantified. And later in grad school at George Mason University, I took a class on constitutional political economy, which is essentially using economic models of decision making to try to understand what political constitutions do, why they look the way they do, and why some are more effective than others at different tasks. And for that class, I had to write a paper, and I wrote a paper based on the written constitution of a prison gang in California. And I thought it was an extremely interesting topic. It turned out that the economic models were highly predictive, and it gave an answer to one question, which is how might gangs organize within prisons and why might they need a constitution? And it raised a bunch of other ones, which is why are gangs more important in some places than in others? What are the consequences of their existence? And so professionally, I've just sort of asked a question and generated more questions and tried to get some understanding on those things. Yeah. And so in a somewhat spontaneous or emergent way, it's been a very interesting research project. Yeah.
Well, there is a conventional wisdom that a group of criminals in prison would exist in a perpetual state of anarchy. But actually, as you detail in your book, inmate society is surprisingly orderly and organized. You mentioned this constitution that you wrote about. Can you tell me more about the systems, rules, and protocols that shape this order, both from the prison authorities, but also from the prisoners themselves?
Yeah, and the other professional connection to this is that public choice economists in the 1970s, primarily Gordon Tullock and James Buchanan, wrote a series of papers investigating the positive analysis of, the economic analysis of anarchy. So not is it like a good or a bad thing or a good or bad ideal, but like how might we think society and social order will exist in situations where the state doesn't have a substantial presence. And that motivated my interest in understanding prisons, which, you know, in somewhat unintuitive sense, they're places of extreme dominance of the state and surveillance. And yet there are these core pockets or arenas in which people can't or won't or desire not to rely on state-based legal institutions and organizations. And so it provides a fun and interesting opportunity to try to study some of these sort of pre-state or non-state dynamics. And what my work has found is that the social order that emerges in these anarchic, quasi-anarchic settings, it doesn't always look the same. Sometimes it looks drastically different. And so one of the things that I discovered in writing my first book was that at one point, there were no gangs in California prisons. The prison system in California existed for more than 100 years, and no gangs, like those that exist and dominate today, operated within their walls. And so it raises really interesting sort of comparative institutional question, which is, you know, if there's some social order that exists and persists for a long time, why might it be wildly different at some other point in time? And so there's descriptive variation that then calls out for some theoretical and empirical investigation and explanation.
Yeah. Well, you do write about how before the 1950s, there were no prison gangs in the United States. And certainly your book outlines a lot of the history and the way that evolved. And I guess the changing dynamic or the changing demographic of the prison gangs played a big role in there. So maybe coming to this idea that you establish in your book of governance theory and kind of what that means for prison social order, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about how you saw that changing demographic, that changing situation with prison gangs leading to a new form of order emerging.
Mm-hmm. So the approach that I use is very much based on new institutional economics. People like Eleanor Ostrom, Doug North, governance is the sort of function that defines and enforces property rights, that facilitates agreements or exchange, and that aids in the production of collective and public goods. And for me, when I look at prisons, often officials are providing formal governance. They're formally providing those things. But it seems empirically and historically that there's a lot of additional governance that incarcerated people want that is extra legal, that is beyond the scope of formal governance. And so in California, for many years, based primarily on ethnographic studies conducted by sociologists in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, governance was provided in an extra legal way, in a very informal way, in a very decentralized way. Gossip and ostracism are extremely powerful mechanisms of social control. In small communities, everybody knows other people's relative social standing. If your standing falls because you act in a way that people don't appreciate, you feel that. And people don't want to hang out with you. They don't want to support you. They don't want to share a cigarette with you. Likewise, ostracism. If there's few other people to turn to when one group ostracizes you, you really want to avoid doing something that violates the norms. And so in prisons in California before gangs, prisoners followed what they called the code, or sometimes the convict code, which was a set of norms of behavior that emerged. Nobody sat down and wrote out what the norms were. They emerged. They were individuals choosing to either abide by the norms or not, and to either punish violations of the norms or not. And taken together, the code, the convict code, is a pretty sensible set of norms. Don't snitch, don't steal, don't complain, pay your debts back. These are the sorts of norms that I think actually apply just in general in life. Like, try to be a good person, try not to cause a lot of trouble, don't whine too much. And so people could either abide by the norm and have friends and resources, or they could violate those and be outcast and fall in status. And in small communities, especially homogenous communities, that works really well. It doesn't require a lot of resources. It doesn't require a lot of organization. And so in small communities of homogenous people, norms tend to provide extra legal governance extremely effectively. So what I discovered in writing my book, though, is that starting in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then certainly in the 90s, There's a huge increase in the prison population in California, and it becomes much more diverse. And that has two different effects. The first is that in bigger prison populations, the information cost of knowing people's relative standing just skyrockets. It's tough to know who's in good standing, who's not, and for what reasons, and how reliable that is. And so the threat of losing status kind of diminishes. It's not as powerful because there's just so many different people there. The second, in terms of homogeneity, is that prisons became much more racially and ethnically diverse during this period. And that had a few different effects. But one of them is that there's a lot less agreement on what constituted a violation of the norms, what constituted the severity of the violation, and then how does somebody come back into good standing. And as more people with different backgrounds, different cultures, different world experiences come into that collective conversation, it was less clear sort of who was right and who was wrong and when and where and why. And so it becomes much less effective as a coordination mechanism for informally or in a decentralized way enforcing the convict code. And so what I document in the book through historical and archival evidence is that chaos increases substantially in the 1960s during these periods of demographic change. And the violence that's increasing, the serious acts of violence that are increasing, the riots that are increasing, are all signals that what used to work well doesn't anymore. And that is what motivated the initial founders, creators of prison gangs in California to, in fact, create those groups.
Yeah. So you focus quite, you focused on the United States, and certainly there's quite a lot of study on California, which I believe has the largest prison population in the U.S., right? And this governance theory that you develop is interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is the commonly accepted frameworks are the deprivation theory and the importation theory, which kind of try to explain why these prison gangs exist for other reasons. But this governance theory that you've developed seems to encompass both this period of norms and then this move to prison gangs. And the governance provided by the norms was acceptable and that worked for a period, but when changing demographics came along, it then required a more formalized structure and we got these prison gangs. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things that I find intellectually very appealing is a theory that's relatively parsimonious, but can explain a lot of different variation. And this theory seems to explain the California case fairly well historically. It seems to explain cross-state differences in the United States fairly well. And it also is actually a theory that was taken from economic historians who were trying to understand, you know, the emergence of states in Europe hundreds of years before. And so there's a sense in which it's a radical out of sample prediction of the ability of new institutional economics to explain when we have more decentralized and more centralized governance institutions in operation. So that for me intellectually is very satisfying. I think that it's a high virtue that it has that adaptability. And criminology is a field that I've spent my entire career engaging with and have much appreciation for, but it's a field more than a discipline. So there are people from many different disciplines, many different departments writing about topics in criminology, and the explanations therefore are much more varied than you might expect within a single discipline. And there are ways in which the explanations are undisciplined in that they don't seem to be a part of a broader intellectual architecture to explain some particular set of outcomes or institutions.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting to me as well, this coming back to the idea of private property, of protection, of structures that help promote order. You write, if I go to a store and purchase a bicycle, then it's legally mine. However, if I do not invest resources to secure it, then it won't be mine for long, especially if it's left unlocked. And you also write, unlike normative theories of who should have property rights over something, the positive theory of property rights looks at whether someone can actually enforce a claim. And I think there's something almost, there's something quite profound about the prisons as a site of study, because they're a site of, in a sense, a pure pure physicality. You know, there's these like very strong, athletic men confined into small spaces, and so you almost get a distillation of what would otherwise be a very dispersed effect, maybe out here in the free world. And that's very interesting to me, because that aligns with what you've said about states as well, and the kind of the connection there with the monopoly on violence. You know, who has the biggest stick, who's stronger, who can physically overwhelm someone else. That kind of rule of the jungle kind of comes into this. But it, instead of leading to an anarchic state, it leads to a kind of equilibrium where the violence kind of starts to even out, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's a sense in which the potential for chaos and serious violence creates a huge benefit if you can find ways to avoid it. And so the people actively involved are really caught in the crosshairs far more than us mere observers in terms of the sharp costs and benefits of being able to avoid some of these situations. Prisons themselves are also extremely interesting to me in terms of sort of game theoretic studies of conflict, because there are four characteristics that define them, either through practice or by definition, that are really uncooperative, that should lead to really uncooperative predictions. So there's a selection effect in who goes to prisons. There are people charged with or convicted of crimes. It's not just a random pull from the population. There's also a selection bias in that it's disproportionately people from disadvantaged socioeconomic and minority communities who maybe have access to less education, fewer resources, fewer ways to invest in producing cooperation. There's no choice who your neighbors are going to be in prisons for the most part. So you can't select into cooperative relationships. And there's very few exit options available in the prison setting. So the threat of exit to generate better or more cooperative outcomes is absent. So in each of those four ways, prisons are quite different from society more generally and point in the direction of there should be less cooperation happening there. And so for me, it's even more remarkable and interesting when they're able to eke out organizations and institutions that actually generate cooperation, that have systematic mechanisms for reducing conflict, for facilitating the underground economy. All of those are sort of even more impressive given the disadvantages in which those people find themselves.
Yeah. The other thing that's really interesting is this emphasis on trade and productive economy that you develop. And if we look at, say, subjective preference, you write, criminals, like all people, respond to incentives. However, I mean, these happen to be their own incentives. And, you know, what in the privation of prison, you know, there is a demand for things like illicit drugs that maybe from the outside it would be easy to criticize, but if you look at it from a subjective point of view, you know, that's what these people need to pass the time. And so there is an economy that emerges, and you write quite extensively on how these prison gangs help regulate and in fact enhance that economy. It's a kind of public good within the prison system to enable trade to take place. So maybe you can tell me more about some of the economics and the trade aspect that you discovered.
Yeah, and almost universally, when we study incarcerated populations, there are underground economies. And it's difficult to get access to the underground economy, but everywhere we look, the very first article in economics and one of the first ethnographies of prison life is The Economic Organization of a Prisoner of War Camp by a guy named R.A. Bradford in the 1940s, who was incarcerated in one. And what he finds is what dozens and or if not many more studies have replicated, which is that these economies, these markets emerge, and people have a demand, and there are entrepreneurial people who find ways to call forth supply into the underground economy. In California, in the context that my first book studies, which is, you know, basically the 1960s to the 2000s, drugs, alcohol, tobacco, tattoo equipment, cell phones, these are all things that many incarcerated people want access to that are contraband. And in fact, prison rules prohibit a wide range of goods and services. They prevent exchange amongst incarcerated people themselves. But that doesn't stop the fact that there's a demand and a willingness to pay and a profit opportunity available for an entrepreneur who's able to sort of connect buyer and seller. And so what we see in California and in prisons across the country and around the world through time are markets for these things. And they're executed in different ways. But there's a sort of relentless there's a relentless ability to make these markets happen. And the scarcity is greater than it is on the street. So I think drug prices are typically anywhere from 4 to maybe 6 or 7 times the price on the street. So there is more scarcity there, but it's getting in. And whether I speak to incarcerated people or prison officials, they all say, you know, there's no way to stop it. We can't make prisons these sealed places that can't get access to resources in the underground economy. And of course, once these markets are in operation, and certainly on any scale, there are important questions that are raised, more general questions, which is, how do we avoid conflicts? And when those conflicts arise, how do we resolve them? Is it always violence? Or can we find ways that are, you know, less destructive of the rents that we're getting through some other mechanism? Can we find ways to adjudicate peacefully? And that's what the Convict Code did at one point in California. That's what gangs did later. They said, you know, we're going to resolve disputes, and that's going to, if not eliminate, reduce the amount of violence that's used.
Yeah. Well, again, there's some very interesting connections with political theory around the role of the state. And that here, as you write, for illicit markets to operate effectively, there has to be an arena in which inmates can resolve commercial disputes. If an inmate owes someone money, the lender can work with their gang to be paid. And this certainly resembles the court system or the role of the state in enforcing contracts and that sort of thing. And this is very interesting because we're seeing this like instantiation of this hegemonic relationship that we would see out, you know, with the government of a country. We're seeing that emerge again here in prison walls, and that is fascinating, right? To see that same thing emerge.
It's extremely interesting. There's a sort of small literature of people studying trade beyond the state, stateless exchange. And there's some classic studies that look at this in the context of the sort of so-called free world outside of prisons. And it is pretty remarkable. One thing that from a sort of political theory, philosophy, politics angle that I would note, though, is that a lot of the things that we care a lot about when it comes to state-based decision-making, you know, there's a sort of modern, you know, in modern culture, an idea that with great power comes great responsibility, right? And so the current instantiation of that wisdom is different from Winston Churchill, but Winston Churchill said a lot of things like that. And I think the idea and something to keep in mind when thinking about extra legal, extra state governance is that some of the things we think matter a lot when the state makes decisions are actually absent with the gangs. So when a gang decides that someone has violated some rule and should be assaulted or killed, there wasn't a trial, there wasn't due process, there wasn't a right to face accusers. There's not an appeals process, there's not a Supreme Court through which death sentences essentially can be reviewed. And so a lot of the checks and balances that we think are so crucial when the state wields coercive and even fatal violence are absent in a lot of these extra legal, non-state and prison-based situations. So certain elements of the market emerge, but the politics and the governance doesn't necessarily emerge alongside that or at the same speed.
Well, what's interesting about that, to take a statist stance and play that side of it, perhaps we could look at that as one of the great benefits of modern democratic nation states, is that we have a lineage of, you know, thousands of years of innovation in these systems and these checks and balances, which if we were to reset the clock and start again, you know, we begin from this kind of warlord kind of a place, these kind of warring tribes that, you know, eventually eke out an equilibrium, but it's not a very modern or enlightened place from which to build a political system. And so perhaps criticisms of the state need to be sort of checked with the idea of like, well, what's the alternative? You know, we go back to a warlord.
I think that's definitely the right question, is sort of what's the alternative, right? That's a classic econ.
Yeah.
And part of it, you know, is also like if you look at states worldwide, most states haven't had a well-executed rule of law, historically speaking. It's like an extreme minority of them. So state-based rule doesn't equal rule of law in any sort of automatic or obvious way.
Yeah. And even that question, I mean, we're getting into, you know, some deeper stuff, jurisprudence, but like, what is law? Because in a sense, the law or the moral code of prisons, as you detail, I mean, it comes from a place that's perhaps quite different. It speaks to maybe a certain psychological state that a lot of these people are in. Certainly, their dictates when it comes to certain kinds of prisoners who, you know, automatically get given death sentences for certain kinds of crimes involving, you know, vulnerable people, for example, or the you know, if you talk to the prison authorities, you're instantly, you know, labeled as a narc, I think, or is there a word where you're talking to the prison authorities. Yeah, there's these kind of laws that we don't have out in the free world. You know, we've developed other kinds of ethical moral systems, and so there's this kind of two tracks, and in a sense maybe it's a bit Jungian, but it kind of comes back to like the human psyche in a sense. You know, a lot of these people are disadvantaged people, they come from broken homes, and I wonder if that has an effect on sort of their worldview as to right and wrong, even perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. The sort of law is more emergent, it's less deliberation based. It's deliberated amongst us people who have a systematically different view of the world. And so we wouldn't necessarily expect it to sort of reach the same policy conclusions that the law that our legislative bodies here in the U.S. Come down to. There's a hyper-masculine ideal in prison. That is just it's not consistent with rule of law, and you know, as you mentioned, there are certain crimes for which you have in essence forfeited your rights in the sort of prison system of maybe not law but legal order. And so it emerges, it's much more tribal, right? It's not customary law. And in fact, when I finished my book and I started reading about clan-based societies, it looks a lot more like clan-based society. There's collective responsibility. There are, depending on the clan, you know, certain religious beliefs that largely influence what the law is amongst those groups. So I don't see it as a proto-state, but more as something adjacent. If you lack, maybe say it differently, if you have large, diverse populations and you don't have high-quality government, this sort of tribal rule, tribal law, seems to be the sort of natural third equilibrium to exist. And yeah, it gets us farther than decentralized norms alone would, but it has sort of inherent constraints cooked into it, it seems.
Yeah, I realized the word I was looking for before was snitch. Sorry, for the person who talks to the guards, but what you just said about hypermasculinity is really interesting, because you also detail women's prisons and how you don't see the same formation of gangs in women's prisons in California. Isn't that interesting?
Extremely interesting. And I wrote about this a bit more in my second book on the puzzle of prison order. But these women prisoners are governed by the very same laws and policies that male prisoners in California are. Many of the prisons that women have been housed in were built for men, and yet nothing like these entrenched gang-based structures operate in women's prisons. And, you know, I have a partial explanation for this, which is that those populations have always remained quite small, meaning that they take advantage of the effectiveness of decentralized governance. It's cheap, it works. Why invest in the costly structures of gangs? And that's consistent with this divergence. The thought experiment that I wouldn't like to see as a real experiment would be, well, what if we increase the women's prison population by 80,000 people? That would be a more thorough test, and we could find out if they form gangs, then my explanation seems to predominate. If not, maybe it's something else. But yeah, that variation across gender is quite stark. And the lives of a man or a woman in a prison in California are just so extremely different. It's pretty striking.
Well, to take out the gender aspect of it, though, what's also interesting is you talk about, I believe it's like the special needs units which house homosexual men in prisons, and how they also don't have the same formation of gangs that you see. And so maybe you could talk a little bit more about that. Maybe it isn't about whether someone's male or female, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so I expand on all of this in the second book. That sort of 2 pages you're referring to is essentially my second book. The gay and transgender housing unit in Los Angeles County Jail is controversial, and I don't have an opinion about whether we should have it or not. But essentially, there's a form on prisoner intake that asks if you're gay or transgender. And if you are, the prisoner intake interview is immediately stopped. You're moved to a high visibility area, and then you essentially get put into a different intake process where a team of deputies, at least historically, have interviewed you to find out if you're, quote, really gay. So gay in the sense that these people think you'll be perceived as a victim in the general population. And if you get through that process, then you'll be housed in a much smaller dormitory. There's 3 or 4 dorms of people who have all gone through that process as well. They don't form gangs there. They have something much closer to the convict code, which is consistent with this explanation about size of the population. Also, because of this very unusual and controversial selection or entry process, the people who are there have lived much more similar lives than the people in the general population. They're from similar communities. They've had similar background experiences. They've come from similar neighborhoods to some degree. And so each one of those things means that even if there's a substantial amount of, say, racial or ethnic diversity, there's a lot of homogeneity on other margins. And the similar life experiences that people have had should facilitate these more decentralized mechanisms of control. So it's an extremely interesting housing community. There's very few of those across the United States. And there's been some great legal scholarship on what is happening, and I included it as a way to sort of test this broader idea about prison social order.
Yeah, I do look forward to looking into your second book a bit more. Interesting to see you expand on that. This is interesting, the idea of this diversity, though, and certainly perhaps a confronting idea, but you're right. Research in a broad range of situations finds that greater ethnic and social diversity is associated with lower contributions to public goods and collective goods. And I mean, this is interesting, right? Because, you know, we live in a globalized, multicultural world. Certainly many countries, you know, there's questions around immigration, around different kinds of people integrating. How do you interpret that? I mean, it could perhaps be a bit confronting for some people, this idea that actually lowers the public goods and these kind of communities, perhaps.
So I think it's pretty well established in the sort of economic literature that ethnic fractionalization is a sort of popular measure of that. And we won't get into the details of how it's measured, but basically, the more fractionalized you are, the more diverse you are. And we find that it correlates with less public good provision, people less willing to fund local schools, pay their taxes, all of these things that are sort of what we like to think of as good for society. And there's a lot of different mechanisms that might explain why macro level diversity reduces that sort of public willingness to pay. I don't have an opinion about which one of those is necessarily right. And so I view that as a challenge to overcome. So in some settings, research by political scientist Jessica Trunstein, for example, shows that we recognize that diversity cools our interest in public goods investment. And so there's an endogenous response where we say, well, let's work harder to respond to that problem. And so the actual effect is smaller than we might think it is theoretically. Division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. So the Adam Smithian sense of let's include everyone pushes for let's have more people. And at some point that means more diversity. I think this more empirical literature now says, well, there, you know, we have to find a way to facilitate not just larger communities, but larger and more diverse communities. A lot of the times people will ask me about the Nordic prisons, and maybe you've seen a documentary about them or read about them. But they're extremely, you know, posh in one sense, right? There's like tons of resources. They've got these great environments to live in, lots of resources. And, you know, the literature there seems to think that in these small, highly homogenous countries, they're willing to pay for resources like that, you know, because it's someone like them there. And it's not obvious that we would have that same intuition here, that we're just happy to pay because, you know, there's someone like me there. It might be that the diversity reduces public willingness to sort of pay in or be taxed for these sorts of resources.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if there's nuance here, because I did a little bit of research. I'm from New Zealand originally, and I did a little bit of research just comparatively, you know, looking at the New Zealand prison situation. And at the end of the day, I mean, there is racial differences, but New Zealand, you know, it's an island country. It doesn't share any land borders. And I wonder this idea of diversity, whether somewhere like California, where you do have a large population of people coming from Mexico, you've got people with Mexican background, you've got maybe this kind of crossroads of quite different cultural backgrounds that would otherwise maybe integrate over time in an island country or somewhere like Scandinavia, where, yeah, you know, the Nordic countries. I wonder whether there's a nuance here where this idea that ethnic and social diversity can be countered through institutions such as, you know, schools that actually, you know, bring children together from different backgrounds, and they start to kind of become, even though they might have like an ethnic background that's different, they kind of start to form around norms of identity, of belonging. Whereas, you know, somewhere like California, where maybe there's a large immigrant population, there's a lot of people coming in from Mexico, South America, Latin America, whether that all feeds into this kind of mix of kind of incompatibility, different social backgrounds, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess my intuition is that there's a well-established macro relationship. There's a lot of possible explanations for it. Social capital plays an important role here at some point, where we have bonding social capital, where we establish more connection with the people who are like us. And then there's bridging social capital, where we're connecting with people from different groups, from different backgrounds. And in a place like California, that's not just diverse, but mobile, maybe these communities are more in flux. And what we see when we look at the sort of extreme other side, so there's Lisa Bernstein has this famous paper on Orthodox Jews in the diamond trade in New York. And the homogeneity there is community, it's religion, it's business. They view the world in a very specific type of way, and they can lean into that to get the cooperation. So my sense on sort of diversity, which I certainly wouldn't stop at ethnic diversity, I think it's much, much broader than that. I think the concept of social distance from anthropology and sociology is extremely relevant here. But all those other ways, and we're much more different, it's harder to lean into those differences to get the good outcome in more diverse places.
Yeah.
And so it's up to sort of institutional entrepreneurs to find ways to, like, you know, overcome those differences.
Well, would it be true to interpret that statement, though, this idea that maybe in the 1960s, 1970s, when there was an increasing diversity, that's when there was increasing challenges within the prison system? But would you say that perhaps these prison gangs are actually, in a sense, reducing diversity by amalgamating it into blocks, per se? And so you've got these kind of different ethnic blocks that, in a sense, actually, the average distance between a prisoner, because they're now locked into an ethnic block, is maybe lower, and so thus less violence and maybe a higher quality of living. Is that accurate? Or
yeah, that's interesting. I guess my sense is, yeah, I mean, so the gangs simplify lots of differences into a few important differences: black, white, Hispanic, other. That's what they would say. And then geographically, are you from Northern, Central, or Southern California? And that's sort of the thing that matters the most about you. And the gangs do that, and there's a way in which, okay, now each gang is responsible for their quote own people, and that's the by far most salient aspect of a person's identity. So that's a really interesting observation. I think that's true, that they, as a matter of fact, have isolated a few characteristics to be extremely important and to just sort of ignore a bunch of other ones.
Well, the other thing that would lead credence to that is this idea of self-governance. So say, you know, you have a white gang, and if someone steps out of line and kind of brings in a diversity of their own, you know, they do something way out on the spectrum, the gang will actually enforce that and kind of bring it back in. And you write about this, you know, they'll punish their own people who go out and do something without the consensus of the gang. And so it kind of, in a sense, homogenizes the behavior a little bit more, and they get the same tattoos, they got the same haircut, they all do the same thing, and they're the same race. And it's sort of, yeah, I think it's an interesting kind of approach to identity.
I mean, prisons flatten identities. You know, the classic, they give you a number to replace a name, which is not entirely true, but yeah, you can't wear what you want, dress how you want, act how you want. And the gangs exert tremendous in-group pressure, punishing their own affiliates when problems, either social or economic, arise with other groups. And, you know, one of the telling clues in this, you know, evidence is that if some group doesn't bring a new prisoner into the fold, it's the other guys who say, hey, you need to incorporate that person into your group, because they want them to be governed by that other group. And so, yeah there's very much, I mean, it's certainly not fully voluntarily chosen, but people have to affiliate, and the gang says, these are the things that matter, and we're going to keep an eye on you, and we're going to make sure you follow the rules.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the concept of homo sacer?
I don't think so.
So the Latin concept of, you know, the condemned man living outside, you know, say living outside of a Roman city in ancient times, and effectively not of any particular city-state or any particular tribe affiliation, and thus kind of becomes subhuman, becomes a target, can be killed by anyone without any legal repercussions. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar? Because I wonder whether in this case someone, I mean, I don't know if it's even possible to not join a prison gang in California, but if you try not to, you become this kind of vulnerable individual, you know, the homo sacer in a sense, who can and will be taken advantage of, right, by others.
Yeah, in California, for the most part, you're automatically going to affiliate with some group. Okay. And there's ways to opt out, but some group has to be responsible for your behavior. And in general, like, my sense is that people want that because they don't want some lone wolf who's gonna do something disruptive. They don't want some guy who's gonna cause trouble and, you know, initiate a large riot that leads to people getting hurt or stabbed. You know, for many years, the Department of Corrections would just put everybody of a particular race on lockdown after a riot. And, you know, nobody wants to be locked down for weeks and months. Yeah. So, you know, we don't want somebody who is unaccountable or unaccounted for in the prison system. And I think that's true today. Some people can opt out through, you know, certain religious affiliations if done in the right way. But no, I mean, for the most part, somebody has to be responsible for, some group has to be responsible for everyone.
Yeah. Well, again, this is interesting to me because it sort of mirrors the nation state, right? You know, it's, you need to affiliate with the nation state. You can't, generally speaking, you know, there's very few cases where people are outside of those systems, the sort of hermetically sealed nation states, and certainly more parallels there. But so something I wanted to come back to, this idea of the mafia and the formation of protection, and in particular the Mexican mafia that you write about, because I thought this was fascinating, that the Mexican mafia in California, it's a Californian prison gang, but it only has a few hundred official members, but it's able to exert control over very powerful street gangs on the outside, such as MS-13, who are known for incredible brutality and violence. How is it that the Mexican mafia can have such an outsized impact compared to the street gangs to become sort of the gang of gangs?
It's extremely interesting. And it's not limited to the Mexican mafia. In fact, there's gangs in Northern California that play a similar role there, and places in New York and Baltimore. But a few number of people who can control the county jail and then later the state prison, but especially the county jail, have an extremely credible threat of violence. So there may be hundreds or thousands of people who are in gangs on the street. Maybe they're armed, maybe they're experienced with violence. But when that one person is arrested and taken to jail, they don't have the rest of the gang with them. They don't have a weapon with them. They may not be knowledgeable about the structure and the organization, the architecture of a jail. And, you know, a handful of well-organized and well-armed prison gang members can basically say, when you get here, if you haven't done what we've said, if you haven't paid our gang taxes on your drug sales, we have a list, and they had lists. And now that things have gone digital on phones, it's even easier to keep and communicate and update lists. So people on the street anticipate quite rationally that they will be incarcerated in the future. The prison gang will have a credible threat to hurt you, and they'll have information about whether you paid or not. So you can either not pay and be in grave danger when you're locked up in the next year or two, or you can pay now and then receive instead the protection and safety of that gang. And so this relatively small number of people are able to amplify and project this tremendous amount of localized incarcerated power across large parts of Los Angeles. And there's a sort of stationary theory, a stationary bandit theory of state formation by Mansur Olson. And he basically argued that once you have the credible threat of violence, you can extort more if you can protect that person from other extortionists. So you want to be the sole extortionist. And it may be that if you can increase the revenues from which you're extorting, you'll have an incentive to not only provide protection, but to, you know, produce a market or to pave roads or provide local public goods that allow the earnings to increase such that even more can be taken from those. And we see that in Los Angeles. The Mexican mafia is the informal court, the sort of quasi-government. When there are disputes between rival gangs, they make rules about what sort of violence can be used in the street. Most famously, in the early 1990s, they forbid drive-by shootings amongst Hispanic gangs in Los Angeles. And the numbers of drive-by shootings collapsed instantly and for many, many months. So they write rules about behavior, they write laws for gangs, and they adjudicate disputes amongst them. So it's a really shockingly high level of control exerted beyond prisons, you know, illustrating the fact that prisons are not silos. They're permeable. They you know, there are influences into them, and there are influences spread out to the outside.
Is there a sense of diplomacy that exists between the gangs and also with prison authorities, like in terms of these structures? I mean, do prison authorities consult the shot callers when it comes to the way the prison is run and sort of particular issues?
So in a general sense, like, it's clear that that does happen. I suspect that it probably varies in different prisons, depending on who's working, the personalities of correctional officers, personalities of the shot callers who are involved. There are examples in my book where they consult about which people should be housed together in the same cell, for example. I think that in some instances, at some point, people, correctional officers, would sort of recognize that they're delegating a certain amount of control and governance to shot callers. I think to some degree, shot callers are able to also pull it away from correctional officers. It's not a one-way voluntary surrender of power. But people who are shot callers in gangs have a lot more information than correctional officers do. They have, in a sense, a wider range of penalties available. They're less accountable to some extent. And it makes sense, I think, that they would be able to entrench themselves in these important ways. And what we've seen is that even when you go to the highest security prisons in California, the gangs are just as, if not more, important in those places, meaning that, you know, you can't just easily lock up the gang problem and end it. There's a sort of relentless series of people who are going to step in to fill those roles, because what they're providing isn't purely predatory. It's not purely extortionist. What the gangs provide is more safety in a dangerous environment, a way to adjudicate conflicts in communities where those things are real and have really negative consequences. And so whenever you lock up one gang leader or shot caller, or if you were to lock up an entire gang, there's a market profit opportunity available to somebody who can fill that power void going forward.
I'm really interested to talk now about money and medium of exchange within the prison system. And you suggest that stamps replaced cigarettes as a medium of exchange. Yet also my impression from the book is that, you know, dollars also really important in the prison economy. Can you tell me more about the trade, the actual medium of exchange, and how money works within prisons?
It's probably changed a lot since I wrote my book, or at least okay. I wouldn't want to speak too much about what's happening now. Okay. Cigarettes, historically, very important medium of exchange. Now, meaning 20 years ago, the stamps seem to be like the medium of exchange for all the reasons that, you know, it's divisible. It's, you know, it's going to stick around. It's not going to degrade. There's a real use value for it. Now, with the proliferation of cell phones in prisons and apps that can allow you to, shoot money around, these problems, which weren't a huge problem before, I think are even easier to solve now. So if you went back to the 90s and you wanted to do a drug deal, there's two people in prison. One's going to get the drugs in. The other wants to pay the person for doing so. The buyer would ask a family member or a friend on the outside to give X amount of money to the incarcerated person's friend or wife or somebody. And so there'd be an exchange for money on the outside, an exchange of goods on the inside. And, you know, with digital currency now and all that, I just imagine that that problem's much less of a problem even now.
Yeah, maybe this is anachronistic, but I also, my understanding is like ramen noodles have played a role. And do you know if that's still relevant, if that's something that people...
You know, at different times, ramen noodles, honey buns, some things are more and less, you know, available and in demand for exchange.
Yeah.
I assume that it's very context dependent about what's the sort of most generally agreed upon, commonly used medium of account.
Yeah, I guess the reason I ask that is, I'm very interested in money, and I got some more questions in that regard. But this idea of like how that forms, and if, you know, we're looking here at say the formation of tribes, you know, mirroring the nation state. Also wondering whether, you know, some of these other attributes of monetary systems or central banking, etc., you know, if we can see analogies. And like, for example, you know, if we were to take ramen noodles as the medium of exchange in a certain prison, you know, what would it mean for the prison authorities to increase or decrease that supply, and what would the impact of that be? These are hypothetical questions, but certainly interesting to me, you know, how the emergent nature, the emergent way that money is decided on within a certain context is quite interesting.
Yeah, and state officials try to prevent that. So in California 15 years ago, there was a limit on how many stamps you could have in your personal property.
Okay.
Because they didn't want you to just have your big bank there. The Radford article that I mentioned before is the best or most enjoyable description of the evolution of these. So I don't know if you know this article, but he basically documents how the Red Cross is like sending these endowments down to all the prisoners, and some like the coffee and some like the chocolates and some like the cigarettes and some don't. And there's this exchange that happens, and there's a priest who is able to move across multiple housing units in this POW camp. And he knows what the exchange values across all of them are. And so he leaves with like the standard package and comes back with three times as many things because he's able to arbitrage across these different separated protected markets. So the description of the evolution of markets there is really first rate.
Yeah. Well, on that sense as well, that this idea of governance structures of, welfare, of public good, coming back to the Mexican mafia, You also write here, the Mexican mafia reportedly increased the routine volume of goods available for all prisoners, making more goods available at lower prices. And the condition of many Chicanos and convicts has been significantly improved because of this. You know, these prisoners claim they're in a better position. The Chicano prisoners, that is Mexican ethnicity prisoners, claim they're in a better position than other groups inside of prison because of this work, this kind of public good, this infrastructure that their gang is providing.
Yeah, I mean, getting access to the contraband is a major benefit to your group. And then if they're able to, if that revenue stream generates incentives to produce public goods, then that's a direct and an indirect or a personal and a more general way of improving one's life on a sort of daily basis.
Yeah. And I do want to just come back to this bigger idea of the state then, David. I'm wondering if what your views are on, I guess, questions of state and if this has figured into your study of prisons.
Well, how do you mean?
So I guess politically, if there's certain schools of thought that you have informed your background, perhaps in terms of general political, economic, social theories, these kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that states are coercive entities that, under some conditions, benefit the common humanity and others don't. I think that James Madison, one of the great founding fathers of the United States, the author of the U.S. Constitution, was a genius man, and he said that, you know, the benefits that states give us require us to give it coercive capacity, to empower it. And when we empower it, it's strong enough to protect our rights, and that power also means it's strong enough to violate our rights. So the grand political challenge is empowering states and constraining them to use that power in ways that's desirable for the people who are governed by it, who are governed within it. And that's a problem that the gangs face. You know, they wanted gangs that were strong enough to protect their rights, but then not use that power to violate it. And I think that's the challenge for political development, is how do we get states with the information and the incentives to use the power in ways that are constrained by our social desires for what it's doing. And yeah, the bigger the society and the more diverse it gets, that's a harder problem to solve. So that's why I don't think many states have successfully done that and done it for sustained periods of time.
Yeah, thank you for that. I guess I ask again, yeah, I live in Japan, but I'm from New Zealand. And so both these countries have, I guess, different social understandings, public understandings of the role of the state. I think, you know, Japan's a very collectivist place, Confucian ideas of right and wrong, you know, different conceptions of rehabilitation. Perhaps New Zealand, a very tight-knit place, but small, a small country with kind of egalitarian origins, but definitely defers to the state more. And so what you've just shared, I think, is a there's this kind of idea of looking back at the founding fathers, their role, their critique of the state is very fascinating. And I do see that come through in your writing, I think, which is why I asked about it, because certainly it seems like there is an opportunity for progress to be made, especially on just on a human level with these prisons, where, you know, perhaps we can learn from what's not working and what is working, even to improve outcomes and kind of the overall quality of life, so that there is maybe the opportunity to rehabilitate people into the community, right? And maybe this is a bit of a bigger topic, but this is a ballooning prison population, which I think it's like over 2 million people in the United States, right? Which is quite incredible to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's gone down a little bit, but it's okay. Massive, and it'll be difficult. It's easy to send people to prison. It's very difficult to get them out. Yes. And there are widespread social, political, and economic fallout from prisons. For me, I think that while mass incarceration has been misguided and you know, a failure, it was a response to a substantial social harm. which was dramatic increases in violent crime and the homicide rate. And there was different ways that we might have responded, and we chose one that turned out to be very ineffective. And so I think that affects the country in terms of the citizens that we're making. There's been a lot of really interesting work in political science about how contact with the carceral state, whether it's incarceration, arrest, or even being detained for tickets, dramatically affect people's willingness to invest and participate in political activities and to invest in other pro-social, nonprofit style activities. So the impact of the prison as the state entity on society has been huge and in many ways quite destructive.
In the United States, do prisoners have the right to vote?
I think in two states that they do, and there are not massive dramatic differences across those two places.
Okay, that's interesting, because one other little fact that you mentioned, which was quite interesting, is that I think before the 1960s, prisoners who entered the system lost their civil rights, and they faced civil death, which is very interesting, right? It's sort of an exodus from the free world into this new world.
And of course, the 13th Amendment eliminates slavery, but not for incarcerated people. It says it's specifically there. And so in most states, there is forced labor by incarcerated people, typically at extremely low wages.
Is there any constitutional work on that you know of?
No, I think it's the 13th Amendment.
Okay, but in terms of like people concerned about that and the human rights side of that, or is that locked in and it's not going to change?
Oh, I mean, I think there's lots of people working in this sort of space who wish that it didn't say that. I'm not sure if there's any real political momentum to change that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just sorry, not to go off on a tangent, but that, it's interesting that kind of role, like political enfranchisement, disenfranchisement.
Different states have different felon disenfranchisement laws. For many of them, it's just while you're incarcerated. For others, it's while you're sort of still, under supervision by the state. And in a few cases, not very many at this point, it's sort of lifetime disenfranchisement. Right. And so, you know, the criminology studies that look at this go through and look at congressional elections and presidential elections, and they try to estimate for people how many people were free, who would have been able to vote but couldn't. And we guess about, based on demographics, how many vote Republican, how many vote Democrat, and were any of those races close enough that felon voting might have changed it. And in something like 4 or 5 of the congressional votes in the last 30 or 40 years, it would have mattered. And that effect is amplified because once you get into Congress, it's much easier to stay there. And so if there's some arbitrary reason one person's elected instead of the other, then it probably matters. And then in 2000, Bush and Gore was decided by an extremely small number of people in a very localized place in Florida. And it's quite plausible that if felons could have voted in Florida at the time, we would have had a different president elected. So these two things do have a pretty substantial impact.
Yeah, I'm curious. Again, the United States situation is interesting that, you have these kind of parallel structures forming, and perhaps on the rehabilitation side, you know, reintegrating with political structures, civic structures of the free world, would be an interesting area of exploration. I'm sure there are people looking at this, but losing all, you would almost feel that the prison gangs and the mafias would, they offer more perhaps, and so you get recidivism and people coming back into the prison system and not being able to escape that that cycle potentially.
Yeah, I think that's true of a lot of different places where mafias are important. There's a tension or a pull from the state to the mafia. The state doesn't want you to just pay their extortion. They want you to turn to them for governance.
Yeah.
So there's competition over the sort of civic location of, people's minds.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, just on that note of the state, the other thing that sort of stood out to me, this idea of the tribute of the tax. It seems that we end up at this number of about 10 to 30%. it's not enough to like fully shut down and destroy the productive base, but it's also, you know, it is still extracting. And that number seems to be the same whether it's a prison gang or the nation state, which is very fascinating to me. It's almost, it goes back in time, right? All the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's an overly simplified idea about supply side economics, where if you tax too high, people earn less because they don't want to pay it. And you can sometimes increase your total tax revenues by reducing the rate because people will still earn a lot and they're happy to give you less over more when you take more over less. And I suspect that there's something like that going on.
Yeah. Just the final topic, David, I would like to explore, if that's okay, please. Moving beyond the context of prison economies just a little bit, I'm very interested in political economy broadly, and in particular the technology of Bitcoin. Is Bitcoin something you've encountered before? I mean, could you just give me an idea roughly if you know much about Bitcoin before I ask a few questions?
I've got some Ethereum and some Bitcoin in an account, and beyond that, know essentially nothing about it.
No, okay, well, look, let's boil this down into some principles then. For me, anyway, I see Bitcoin as a new logic of payments. You know, there's no way to undo or reverse the transaction without consent. In principle, Bitcoin cannot be confiscated. It can exist in secret. You may not even know if someone has it or not. And in short, it is the system without trusted third parties or middlemen. And the only conclusion I come back to as I've studied this deeply is that somehow this nature of Bitcoin can bubble up into our relationship with the state, perhaps enabling new ways of social organization and protection. And I wondered if you had any thoughts based on maybe what you know or any kind of conjecture on what this kind of new form of money could mean for the way we interact with power structures, perhaps.
I don't have much to say about that. Okay. My sense is that it's not just a currency, but it's a way of enforcing contracts. And since the state is what many people turn to enforce contracts, I would welcome innovations and advances in any capacity in terms of, you know, doing that and doing that better.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, I'm very interested as we move into this kind of increasingly digital world, maybe we see fracturing or challenges around ideas of nation and borders and trade. Certainly the United States is beginning this process of tariffs, and there's trade wars and all sorts of things happening. And you know, casting my mind out, and again, this goes, I appreciate this goes beyond your writing, but I do wonder if there's something here where, you know, something like this smart contracting you talk about, or stateless money, kind of provides a vehicle in a way that allows trade to happen without going through these official structures, and in a sense mirroring what we see with these prison economies, perhaps, where new, you know, there's official rules that, you know, de jure govern trade, but actually people find ways to do things without that middleman of the state.
So much of economic and commercial conflict avoids state-based legal adjudication because it's slow and it's costly and it's highly regulated. And, you know, perhaps Bitcoin and technologies that function in those ways are going to provide lower cost ways, and maybe we'll ask the state to do different things than it does now.
This would come back, what you just said would come back to the side of institutional economics and transaction economics, right? Like, what is the cost of adjudication, and is it easier to sort it out between yourselves? Maybe there's something in here. And I mean, look, this is a new area, I think, but certainly a real focus for me, and really fascinating to see this emerge, to see that the way trade and these structures form within prisons. And then just finally, I mean, the other place, I don't know if this is on your radar at all, but the other place where this is really interesting is online multiplayer video games, which in a sense is a similar kind of a structure where there's a self-contained economy, there's official rules, and then emergent rules. There's a connection to the real world, but it's also sort of isolated. Is this something you've encountered at all, or is it something?
Yeah, I've seen a few papers on it. I can't tell you the authors or the titles, but
yeah.
You know, what's really fun about these sorts of studies is it's something that emerges, you know, rather than being designed, and it emerges, and it turns out that it works pretty well. And then, you know, importantly, well, how does it emerge and why is it working well or not? And as case studies in the emergence of social institutions, yeah, I'm a big fan of those sorts of papers. And as long as we also look at all of the instances where the social emergence leads to really bad outcomes, right? It's very easy to select on the dependent variable when the economy looks really good or things work really good. But there's plenty of failures out there that we should also study to know why sometimes it works better than others.
Yes, and I'm certainly reminded of Hayek's ideas around Friedrich Hayek's ideas of spontaneous order and the emergence of institutions here. It's not the kind of thing that we could design. It just happens naturally from people collaborating and working together. But look, David, really fascinating. I really enjoyed your book and your writing. It really got me thinking, I must say. And I think this concept of the order emerging within these, you know, ostensibly chaotic systems is very fascinating. You mentioned your second book that you wrote as well. What was the title of that one?
It's called The Puzzle of Prison Order, Why Life Behind Bars Varies Around the World.
Okay.
So I look at Brazil, Bolivia, some of the Nordics, men's prisons in England, women's prisons in California, and the gay and transgender dorms that we discussed earlier. And it's a more unwieldy set. It's a little more exploratory. And I'm making two main arguments there. One is why life varies across those places. But the second and more important argument is a methodological one to my colleagues in criminology, which is that comparative ethnographic studies of prison social order should be a thing. The vast, vast majority, 99% of ethnographies are single site or single country studies. And we need to take a comparative turn. Since the 1970s, comparative political scientists have developed an extremely good literature on how to think through comparing cases in different places and times. The tools are there, and we as criminologists need to just grab them and start comparing across countries to better understand the informal life of prisons.
Yeah, that's incredible. And what's next for you? What's on your radar? Are you working on any new projects at the moment?
I've done a little bit of initial work on rehabilitation programs in South Carolina. They actually have a very low recidivism rate, so when people leave their prisons, they tend not to come back. It's been a priority. They have a lot of innovative and it seems effective programs to get people back on track upon release. So one project will be looking at, you know, successes and failures of rehabilitation in the United States. And then I'm hoping to work on a more popular oriented book on the role of policing in the 21st century in the United States.
That's fascinating. And if people want to find more, they want to follow you, where do you want to send them, David?
You can follow me on X at David Scarbeck, and davidscarbeck.com posts all my papers and links to my books.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me and sharing your wonderful insights, informative insights on your writing and your book, The Social Order of the Underworld, How Prison Gangs Govern the American Penal System. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much.
I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.